is a lecture by Rabbi David Kaplan. Rabbi Kaplan is originally from Chicago. He attended Northeastern University and received his rabbinical ordination in Jerusalem. He has lectured widely in Israel and America and is currently a senior lecturer at the main campus in Jerusalem.
Two thirty-two. We finished? We're on 233, correct. We're about to start 233. So 233, 234, and 235 are all connected. They all have to do with the laws of judging. That 233 is that a judge should not pervert justice. You'll find in the Torah several times the Torah repeats the warning to the judges that the judges must be meticulous in meting out justice. They're not allowed to take bribes. And the whole theme, the Torah keeps repeating it over and over again about how a judge has to be very careful. And the Torah says, Din pruta kedin me'amonet. That means when you're judging a case, if the litigation, they're contending over a small amount of money, it's the equivalent, you have to use the same type of, the judge has to have the same attitude when there's a small amount of money as when there's a large amount of money. It makes no difference. That means you don't take one case, and because this case there's a lot of money at stake, that becomes the major case. It comes before the other case, and you report that case. In Torah law, all the sensationalism surrounding any type of major lawsuit would be no different than in a case where there's a small amount of money at stake. Because ultimately, the underlying theme is there's got to be justice consistently from start to finish. That's 233. 234 is that the judge is not allowed to honor one litigant more than the other one. That means when the litigants come into court, two people are fighting in court, the judge is not allowed to, the example they use over here, the judge is not allowed to let one of them sit while the other one stands. Now, what's the idea? Why not?
To respect.
What will be?
It's partial to one of the other.
And what happens if he's partial? Okay, so there's what's going through the judge's mind coming in. There's what's going through the judge's mind. The judge himself becomes partial by showing some type of a favoritism towards one over the other. But it's also for the benefit of the litigants. The litigant, when you walk into court, if you see the judge, when you walk into court, you got, let's say you and some other guys smashed cars, right? You had a traffic accident. And you go to court, right? Let's say the guy's an Italian, right? The guy, you and some Italian smashed your cars up, right? Then you go into court, and the judge's name happens to be also Judge Lorenzo Gucci or something, right? He's also an Italian. And as you and your buddy, you and your co-litigant walk into court, the judge looks up at him and says, "Hey, Frank, see you on the back nine later this afternoon," right? Now, how do you feel at that moment? You haven't even spoken yet. The case hasn't even begun. Now, you may as well take out your wallet right then and there, save yourself some time, take out a 50, put it on the table and leave, right? Because you're gone, right? The Torah says that the fact that the judge honors the other person more than you, that automatically what that does is it has a certain intimidating effect on you. When you see that he's being honored, you're not going to be able to make your claim with the level-headedness that's needed because you see that the other person is at an advantage. It's an interesting halachic question. If you're in a country, I think we spoke about this once, remember we talked about bribing judges? Bribery is prohibited. Now, you're not allowed to bribe. What about if you're in a situation where the only way to get a fair shake is if you bribe the judge? Right, let's say you're traveling through Turkey. Right? Turkey, where you saw Midnight Express, right? Right? So this, I still to this day, every time I hear people tell me they're traveling through Turkey, I get nervous. Right? But let's say you're in Turkey and you're in a rented car. Do they have cars in Turkey?
I don't know. Sure.
They have cars. Okay. Let's say you're in a traffic accident in Turkey, right? And the judges there are notoriously corrupt, right? Are you allowed to bribe the judge in court? It's an interesting halachic question. If you know that the only way to get a fair trial is by bribing the judge, then you're, in other words, there you're not bribing him to tilt it in your direction. You're bribing the judge in order to get a fair shake, because you know for sure that the other judges bribed him. Under those circumstances, halacha is you're allowed to bribe the judge, right? Because there you're bribing for survival. You're not bribing in order that he should twist justice in your direction, right? I think there are other countries, some of these little countries where you know that the judge is on the take, right?
Well, in the South and the States.
In the South, right? Well, in the South and the States, if you're right, or where you know the guys are looking at
speed trap,
right? A couple of cops with the sunglasses, the shiny, you know, the mirror reflecting sunglasses take you in, right? We got us a Jew boy here, right? And they get in the court, right? And they, you know, first thing is they're looking for your horns, right? And then you know you're in big trouble. So there you are allowed to. You can do anything you have to because you could be in big, your life may be in danger, right?
So that, from Turkey to represent them, you can hound a turkey. You're gonna have to leave the South alone.
Leave the South.
You don't need to propagate beer glass to Southern police.
Oh, Virginia's not really South, you know. It's just kind of not really anything, right? But it's not South. 235. I'm talking about Mississippi, Don. Deep South, yes.
What about Trinity, South Carolina? Where is like where is the Beit Din stand today? Like, obviously, like, is it only just like Meshurim and Rulo and like the Jewish communities? Or do we have it? Like, can these things happen on Israeli streets? And about the team, can they take it to a Beit Din?
Okay, that's a good question. The reality of the Beit Din system today is as follows. You can only go to a Beit Din if there's a situation where the two litigants agree to go to Beit Din. Right now, if they do, according to halacha, you're supposed to do that. Two Jews that have any type of litigation whatsoever have an obligation by halacha to settle their differences in Beit Din. Right? They must go to Beit Din. There are Beit Dins all over. Generally, every city has a Beit Din. Each group, you may have the Satmar Beit Din and the Litvisha Beit Din and the Chabad Beit Din. You have different Beit Din. Whatever Beit Din you want to go to, as long as they're qualified rabbis, you are allowed to and you must go to Beit Din. The problem is, there's a technical problem. Beit Din has no power of enforcing nowadays, right? So you're talking about people who will only go to Beit Din. You have to be God-fearing to the extent that you are going to abide by the ruling of Beit Din. I could tell you a ruling recently that took place which involved a tremendous loss of money for one of the parties involved. There was a group that wanted to open a girls' school, right? They're going to open a girls' seminary. And they're going to open the girls' seminary right in this neighborhood, right? Now, the fact that the guys from Or Sameach are around here probably didn't weigh too much because the guys from Or Sameach are never around here. They're always downtown, so that wasn't a problem. But the fact that there are guys from the Mir Yeshiva, and you got another yeshiva here in Shmuel HaNavi, and you got a couple of Hasidic yeshivas, they were going to put a girls' school right in the center of a very, very strongly yeshiva, single male populated area, right? So they had invested, they were going to take a building, and they invested, it was supposed to be a girls' seminary, it was going to open up, and the yeshivas collectively took these people who were going to open a seminary, they took them to Beit Din, right? They said, we're taking you to Beit Din, we want you to... The truth is, they weren't really taking them to Beit Din as much as the landlord who had rented the seminary, the building, they were taking this landlord to Beit Din. Then the Beit Din ruled that they cannot open the school in this area. Now, the truth of the matter is, they can't possibly enforce it. Right? There is no legal means of enforcing it. You could make things unpleasant and uncomfortable in a Jewish community. You know, you put up big posters. These people are not abiding by the ruling of Beit Din, which could be done. But somebody who went, and it was a tremendous, you're talking about a major loss of money over here. They had to relocate in a different neighborhood, find new facilities and so on short notice. In normal case of litigation, if you take me to Beit Din and I agree to go with you, and then Beit Din rules against me, I turn around and say to you, well, look, sorry, right? I'm not interested in paying you. I thought Beit Din was going to rule for me. I didn't expect him to rule against me. At that point, you can take me to secular court. Right? But if it's not at any point before that, you must go to Beit Din. If you know the person will not respond to your call to Beit Din, or you know that he will not respond to the ruling of Beit Din, then you can take him to secular court. A traffic accident, your example of traffic accident, I don't know what the law is in the secular, there could be the secular law requires that this be settled in a secular court. At that point, you have no choice. But if it's a regular standard case of litigation, then yes, the halacha absolutely requires that you end up in Beit Din. Okay?
Is there a Jewish law that a girls' school can't be near?
It's a judgment call all the way. Right, it's a judgment call. There is no law that the girls' school can't be near the boys' school. No official law on the books, but it's you know, there are just certain times where better good judgment calls for changing the plans, right? And under the circumstances, it would have been a very, very bad idea. Right? So that's the problem. Okay, 235 is the positive command that the judge must judge properly. He must judge righteously and justly. Now, included in this, the verse in the Torah is Bitzedek Tishpot Amisecha. You must judge your fellow man righteously. So, first of all, this is a warning to judges that they have to judge righteously. And now it becomes a mitzvah. According to the commentaries, there's also a mitzvah here that applies to every single one of us. Those of us that are not halachic judges, right, which is none of us, right, we're not halachic judges in the sense that we rule cases of monetary litigation. There is a mitzvah in the Torah of judging your fellow man favorably. Right, that you've heard of. I'm sorry? Bidan lekaf zechus. You have to give your fellow man the benefit of the doubt. If you give him the benefit of the doubt, the Gemara says, if we give our fellow man the benefit of the doubt, God gives us the benefit of the doubt. And it is a positive command. Every time something happens where you give, this could happen, it could basically affect itself in two ways. You could see somebody doing what looks like an Avera, and then you have an obligation to give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that he wasn't really doing an Avera. Sometimes not so easy, right? Guy is definitely putting what looks, smells, and tastes like a cheeseburger into his mouth. Right, it's difficult to give him the benefit of the doubt. You have to come up with some type of scenario where you can judge him favorably. Let's say you assume that he has some type of ulcer condition, and if he doesn't eat right now, he's going to die. Right? And that's why it's a case of his life's in jeopardy, and that's why he's doing it. If it's a person who is a righteous Jew, somebody who is a righteous Jew who is always conscientious and never sins, or does his best to never sin, you've got an obligation to give him the benefit of the doubt under all circumstances. That means anything that you see him doing, you see him driving a car on Shabbos, you have an obligation to give him the benefit of the doubt. Assume perhaps that he had to rush himself to the hospital, right? Assume that he's a doctor, he's going to save somebody's life. If he's a righteous Jew, you must give him the benefit of the doubt. If he's a wicked Jew, then even if he's doing something that looks good, then you judged him, you assume that he's got ulterior motivation. Right? He's doing something sneaky over because he's got a track record. And if he's your average happy-go-lucky Torah-observant Jew, right? And, you know, once in a while he's got good days and bad days. Once in a while when nobody's looking, he flips a light switch on shot. You know, he's basically a good guy. He's not a tzaddik, but he's certainly not a wicked person. There you can call it the way you see it, but it is meritorious to give him the benefit of the doubt. Right? Now, the idea of judging people favorably, I'll tell you, the best stories are these stories about where people were supposed to be judging other people favorably. Right, and because the endings are very often so unexpected. There was one, there was a guy here in the yeshiva, when I was studying here, about many, many years ago, right, there was a guy here, we were davening in the morning. I told you the story? We're davening in the Beis Medrash in the morning, and right before Aleinu L'Shabbat, some people think the words Aleinu L'Shabbat mean, let us take off our tefillin. Right, Aleinu L'Shabbat. Let our start immediately removing. That's not what Aleinu L'Shabbat means, by the way. But it's generally a signal for tefillin removal. So I was sitting there in the Beis Medrash, and we got to Aleinu L'Shabbat, and of course I look over, and here's a guy. Who it's usually the way it is. I wasn't very particularly fond of this guy anyway. And this guy, I see Aleinu L'Shabbat, starts taking off his tefillin. Right, and this is in the morning, and being a very righteous tzaddik, I thought to myself, why can't he wait like the rest of us? You know, I also want to run into breakfast, right? Why can't he wait for the rest of us? Why has he got to always be the first one into the lunchroom, right? And there I was with a huff of righteous indignation. I continued my davening. I had a direct connection to God, right? And this guy is taking off his tefillin, and he's on the way into the dining room, right? I finished davening, and I'm still thinking about burning up. Usually that's the thing we burn up about, is when we see somebody doing something that we'd really like to be doing ourselves, but we must string up all our self-control. See somebody else grabbing the biggest piece of food at the table, and you think, he's got no manners. Look at that boorish behavior. You see, because I really wanted to grab the first piece, but I'm controlling myself as much as I possibly could. Finish davening, I start walking out of the shul, out of the base medrash, and here's the guy is standing in the back of the shul with a charity cup, collecting charity. Right? He had quickly finished davening in order that he could get back there. So I had him, right? I figured that he was certainly in the lunchroom, you know, fressing out, right? Where the fact was that he had hurried up to get to the back of the shul so he could perform one of the greatest mitzvahs known to man. Right? It goes the complete opposite. There's a famous story with the Ksav Sofer. Ksav Sofer was you've heard of the Chassam Sofer? The Chassam Sofer was a great halachic authority. The Kasav Sofer was his son. I think I told you a story about the coin. The Kasav Sofer, there was a convention of rabbis, very big convention of rabbis in Pressburg. And at this convention, where's Pressburg? In Hungary, right? Where's Pressburg? Hungary? I think in Hungary. Kasav Sofer was the Rav, he was the rabbi of Pressburg. There was a major rabbinic convention at this in Pressburg. And at this convention, the Kasav Sofer, at a certain point, you've got hundreds of rabbis there, the Kasav Sofer pulls a coin out of his pocket and he shows everybody, this is a half shekel coin that existed from the time of the Second Temple period. It's the only one of its kind known to exist. And he pulls out this coin, right? And everybody's ooing and eyeing. Right? So they take the coin and they start passing it around the table and everybody's looking at this rare coin, it's one of its kind. Finally, about 15, 20 minutes later, the Kasav Sofer turns to the man next to him and he says, do you have the coin? He says, no, I don't have the coin. I gave it to him, right? And they start tracing it down the table. The coin has disappeared. Right? They don't know where the coin is. Everybody immediately starts looking. They can't find the coin. Finally, somebody says, you know what? We can't find the coin. I suggest everybody reach into their pockets and see if you got the coin in your pocket. So everybody reaches in. Nobody's got the coin. Finally, somebody else says, you know what? I think every single person should stand up and empty out his pockets in full view of everybody else. Right? That way we'll make sure nobody's got the coin. So everybody says, yes, yes, wonderful idea. Finally, one old man says, no, absolutely terrible idea. No, we should not do that. So everybody's like, oh, right? Everybody's looking at him. The other says, no, absolutely bad idea. So they say, okay, we'll keep on looking for it. They keep looking for another 10 minutes. Finally, someone says, you know what? This is ridiculous. Everybody has to empty their pockets. The old man says, no, no, no. Let's look for it some more. 10 minutes from now, if we don't find it, then we'll all empty our pockets. They're waiting, and within the next 10 minutes, all of a sudden they hear a scream, a yell from the kitchen. One of the hired help comes running in. They found the coin. Somebody accidentally had thrown the coin out. When they're cleaning off the table, they found the coin. So they all turned to this old man. They said to him, you know, what was your objection? Why did you object to emptying out your pocket? So the old man said, look, I really didn't want it to come to this, but since you're insisting, I'm going to have to tell you. He reaches his hand in his pocket, and he pulls out an identical coin, a replica of this half-shekel coin. He says to the people, let me tell you something. I saw that the Ksav Sofer, this great rabbi, was so happy, feeling that he had the only coin of its sort. When I came to this convention, I too own a coin like this, and I was going to show my coin to everybody. When I saw that he had what he thought was the only copy of this coin, I felt I don't want to take away his spotlight. So I was going to keep my coin in my pocket. Could you imagine what would have happened had I reached in my pocket when his coin was missing, pulled out the coin, and then tried to insist that I also had a copy of the coin? There wasn't a person in this room that would have believed me. Right? Therefore, I decided I better keep it in my pocket and hope that we find the other one. Right? He says, and none of you would have given me the benefit of the doubt. None of you would have assumed that I also have such a coin. So the Torah requires that under the circumstances, it's a mind mitzvah. It's what you call a mind mitzvah. It's not something it's not an action mitzvah, it's a mind mitzvah. The Avera of speaking Lashon Hara very often has to do with how you judge other people. Right? If you give people the benefit of the doubt, usually when you speak Lashon Hara, you get upset. What do you do when you see somebody involved in a certain activity that looks questionable? and you want to judge them favorably, right? Yet it's very difficult to come up with some way to judge him favorably. He obviously did something wrong over here. How can you possibly find anything to say, any reason to say, yeah, well, his action was actually justified? One of the Musar greats says, what happens when you lose your wallet? Where do you look when you lose your wallet? Let's say your wallet, person's missing their wallet, they're trying to find it. Where do you look?
As many pockets as you can.
Everywhere. As many pockets as you can, drawers, even the most unlikely places, you look for it because you're desperately trying to find your wallet, right? It's extremely unlikely, but you'll leave no stone unturned. When it comes to judging people favorably, it's the same thing. Right? You have to find some reason, some silly reason, why a person behaved a certain way. You have an obligation to look even in the most unlikely places possible. I mean, this applies in day-to-day life. Somebody pushes you in line in the lunch line, right? You have to assume either he didn't see you, maybe when he was raised in his house, there were 11 brothers and there was only enough food for 10 of them at any given time, right? So he's always desperate to get at the food. There are always factors. There could be sociological factors, there could be personality factors, so many factors to decide why a person, that you could judge a person, give them the benefit of the doubt. Even though you've done that, it doesn't mean you have to ignore the action. Right? Even don't make a mistake. Giving the benefit of the doubt does not mean overlooking the personality trait. If there's a guy that you see is extremely irresponsible, right? Somebody is irresponsible. So on the one hand, you have to give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that his irresponsibility stems from the fact that X, Y, and Z. On the other hand, if you're looking to hire somebody, to give somebody a job, you don't have to hire him. He is, objectively, he's irresponsible. Why is he responsible? For whatever the reasons are. But I'm not interested in the reasons. When I'm looking to employ him, then I employ him based on his skills, not based on what it was that happened to him when he was a child that made him irresponsible at this point. You understand the difference? Yeah.
From what I understand, he said, you have the obligation to judge each event you see. You have to come up with an explanation. You have to look for the good to the likeness, as you would look for your wallet. But that's only for a good person, right? That's only for the person we say is already good. In other words, that's for the good person. For the bad person, we have to see even his good things.
For the good person, it's absolutely mandatory. Right. For a medium, an average person, it's meritorious.
Meritorious, and for a person who is himself a Russia, we should look at even his good things as if he has a self-being.
Correct. Correct.
Now, how do we understand which group to put someone in, except by their actions? And if we're trying to judge each action according to the way that we already see him, it's like, so let's say I see a guy. Now each time he does something rotten, each time I see him he does something rotten, and I think, well, if he's he's a great individual, then each time I should have to come up for an excuse for his actions and that he's a good person. But really, every time I see him, it seems like he's rotten. So maybe
it's a good question.
How do I learn?
What's the answer? The great ones aren't constantly doing things that seem rotten. Right? The great ones only do things that seem rotten once in a while. A guy who keeps shooting baskets and missing, he's a great shot. He just happens to be missing every time I see him. He's on a bad streak. It means he's not a very good shooter. It's not a great shooter who can't hit. He's not a very good. How do you define a great shooter? Right? A great person is somebody who's not involved in rotten. Once in a while, how many times is it that a person is driving his car on Shabbos? Right? Once in a while, you see a guy with a long beard and pay is driving a car on Shabbos. You can assume that he's taking his wife to the hospital because she's pregnant and she's about to give birth. Right? It doesn't happen every week. Right? You can't have more than one wife nowadays. Right? So how many times is he driving a car? Unless you say that he's a member of Hatzalah or he's got a private ambulance service. Right? But then you find out about sooner or later, right? The great people only do questionable things once in a great while. It doesn't happen all the time.
Well, so that response suggests that in essence you have to judge a person by their actions. And you have to judge them by their actions. You see them as good as their actions. Not you see beyond their actions who they really are, but...
take a look at the rabbis in this yeshiva. Just take a group as an example. How many of the rabbis in this yeshiva have you seen involved in questionable activity?
Those are the easy ones. They're the rabbi.
Somebody who's
not the easy ones.
So your average guy in the street?
My Josh.
Your average guy in the street. Your average guy on the street. Yeah, anybody in this yeshiva is a tzaddik, right? But your average guy in the street, if you don't know better, he's your average man. He's an average person. He's your average guy on the street, right? Unless he's known to be a tzaddik. At the point that he's known to be a tzaddik, then you have to give him the reward. What if you don't know this guy at all that I don't know? But most people that you know, you've already, based on their actions, you've already made up in your mind what category this guy fits. Right? He fits a certain category. Okay? There's one last thing I wanted to tell you. Yeah, the Gemara says that if you give people the benefit of the doubt, God gives you the benefit of the doubt. That means God, there's no doubt by God, right? But certain actions which are, so God will give you the benefit of the doubt depending on it, because God works me to connect me to quid pro quo. The story about a guy who dies. He goes up to heaven and he sees the scales, right? And he says, you know, it's his judgment day, right? So the voice says, bring in the mitzvahs, right? So the good angels come running in, you know, they dump all the mitzvahs on the scale, right? A couple of big bags of mitzvahs, right? Then they call, bring in the averas, right? Big massive truck pulls up and they start dumping out, the black angels are pulling out the averas, and the guy's sitting there looking and he's devastated. Oh my goodness, I can't believe they got me for that one. They saw that one, nobody was looking, right? They got me a couple of washers. Also, they said, hold it, what's with that package over there? Those aren't my averas. I never did those averas. What's going on over here? That's not my averas. What is that? And the voice says to him, those are the averas of the people that learned from your actions. Remember that time you left shul early because you had an important appointment? Well, because you took your tefillin off, other people took their tefillin off, or they said, if Schwartz could do it, I could do it too. And they ran out early. Remember the time you were driving on Shabbos because you had to go to an emergency? Well, there are other people that saw you. They started driving on Shabbos too. The guy says, hold it. They were supposed to judge me favorably. They should give me the benefit of the doubt. The voice says to him, what about you? Did you give people the benefit of the doubt? If you gave people the benefit of the doubt, then you could demand that they should give you the benefit of the doubt. If you didn't give people the benefit of the doubt, then you have no right to demand it from others. That's the mita keneged mita. That means your own actions determine the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu relates to you on the Day of Judgment. Okay, now the next mitzvah is very closely related. Yeah.
If you give people the benefit of the doubt, can you, do you think that you're also because of my sign, because you can demand that they give you also the benefit of the doubt?
No, you can't do, just because you, no, you can't. It's an interesting question. Since I judge people, I give people the benefit of the doubt all the time, therefore I could engage in questionable behavior, because they have to give me the benefit of the doubt. No, you're still not allowed to put people in a position that's a stumbling block. You're still creating a... You have to try to avoid questionable behavior as much as possible. You still have to try to go out of your way to avoid it. Yeah.
When you make up these strange stories, like the guy with eating cheeseburger and also is about to die, maybe you don't really believe it. You know, you make up the story.
Okay, so the truth of the matter is the way it works. It's an important question. How do you ever train yourself? Any type of mind mitzvah, or any type of mitzvah, which is an attitude mitzvah. How do you ever get to the point where you really... You have to love Hashem, your God. It says in Shema, I have to love Hashem. Right? I have to love Hashem. I don't feel much different than before saying it, and even if I close my eyes and chuckle. Right? I don't feel that my love of Hashem is... My love of cheeseburgers still is much greater than my love of Hashem. Right? I have to love my fellow man. Right? I have to love my fellow man. I'm not that thrilled over my fellow man. How do you ever develop attitudes? The only way to develop it is through practice, right? You have to practice it. When it comes to judging favorably, especially, what's every human being's gut instinct? When you see somebody, what's every human being? It's an unbelievable phenomenon. What is your natural instinct when you see other people? We are extremely critical. Anybody that you see, you'll always see what's negative before you see in the behavior, before you see what's positive, right? You can say, a wonderful person, I don't like the fact that he has his elbows on the table. Right? Hey, did you meet Tom? Yeah. Tom, yeah, his elbows are always on the table. That we notice. Right? His elbows on the table, I don't like the color of his pants. That we notice. Right off the bat, that we notice. right? What about all the good that he does? We don't generally, it's like a car. When you take the stick shift and you let it go, naturally, it's got a natural starting position, right? Our natural starting positions were critical. We have to work on ourselves so that our knee-jerk reaction is one of judging favorably. The only way you get to that point is by going through any type of situation, by turning around and, as ridiculous as the situation is, coming up with some type of story. The bus driver closed the door on your head, right? if it has not happened to you, you haven't been in Israel a long time, right? It means you're just new to the country, right? It'll happen to you, right? Eventually, it shouldn't happen to anybody, chas v'shalom, but it will. If it's not on the head, it's on the foot, right? One way or another, if it's not on the head or on the foot, then the bus will pull away as you're getting off and throw you for a little spin as you're getting off the door. Your back foot is still on the door. How do you judge a guy favorably? Now you get on the bus and the bus driver, in the door, you get caught in the door. Right? Desire, doink, right? Nails you. Right? How can you possibly judge him favorably? Even under those circumstances, instead of turning around and shouting and yelling, you have to judge him. Maybe he's having a hard day. Maybe he's in a rush because he's got a deadline to meet. Maybe he couldn't see me. Right? Maybe he's been had such a hassle all day. That's why he's in a bad mood. Come up with some type of ridiculous explanation for no other reason than just to train yourself that should be the automatic response. The automatic response is to find. Look, if the bus driver starts laughing, goes, ha ha, got another one, right? And he puts a big chalk mark on his head, nailed another, right? Then obviously there's not much to judge. But if anything short of that, one has to try to condition himself. It's all conditioning. It's all practicing. You know, people talk about Lashon Hara, about how it's impossible. How can you possibly live without speaking ill of other people? Right? How can you possibly talk without speaking Lashon Hara? It's just a matter of practice. All it is practice and conditioning. You're not allowed to look, we spoke about it, not looking at women. How can you possibly go through and not look at women?
Please turn the tape to the other side.